International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, the United Nations is expected to vote on new sanctions against North Korea. A look at what the Iranian elections might mean for the nation. Details of the polls on this Super Tuesday balloting day in the race for the White House. And we hear about controversy at the Academy Awards.
Ever since nominations were announced January 14th, the whole conversation's been about diversity. It's been about 2 straight years of all-white nominees in the acting categories.
It's right here on The Voice of America. The UN Security Council appears set to debate new sanctions against North Korea following last month's rocket launch and January's nuclear test, both activities banned under current resolutions. A vote on a draft resolution is expected to get underway about 20 hours UT, and it follows talks between the U.S. and China, a key ally of Pyongyang's. U.S. State Department spokesman John Kirby was asked about this cooperation during a Monday news briefing.
It's been clear. The secretary talked about this last week when Foreign Minister Wang Yi was here, and he and Foreign Minister Wang Yi talked about it in Beijing 2 or 3 weeks before that there was general agreement between the United States and China that a more robust set of measures needed to be adopted on a multilateral basis, the UN Security Council resolution being the appropriate vehicle for that, to hold the North to account for their increased and continued provocations and violations of international obligations. That's not just me saying that. The foreign minister said that not once, but twice. And so we'll look forward to the deliberations as they go on and to the final language. But China has maintained a position of agreeing with the international community that more needed to be done.
Troy Sangaron of the Washington-based Korea Economic Institute was asked by VOA's Victor Beatty what he expects to see in the final text of the new resolution.
It includes measures that would take and essentially require all UN member states to inspect all cargo entering and exiting North Korea. It would require a ban on the export of jet fuel and other refined fuels to North Korea, in essence grounding its national airline, Air Koryo. It would take and create a specific list of prohibited luxury goods exports to North Korea. And it would also take and basically require the expulsion of North Korean officials or who are found to be engaged in illicit activities. It would also take and limit or ban North Korea's exports of both coal and other minerals.
How likely would these sanctions be effective without China's support?
I think without China's support, it'd be very difficult to enforce this. Most of North Korea's trade goes through China, be it both legal or illicit. And so without China's efforts to take and really clamp down on that and to take and inspect the cargo and to basically monitor its own border, it'd be very difficult to monitor all the traffic and ensure the sanctions are enforced.
How likely do you think these sanctions will be part of the final draft resolution? Have you been talking to various sources who may be aware of this situation?
Yeah, I think much of this will be in the draft resolution. We've seen a delay in the vote, largely due to Russian requests to take and review the resolution. I could see Russia perhaps attempting to take and slightly alter the sanctions to send a message that they are a key player in this process. But I think we'll see the sanctions move through largely as they were designed originally. I think one of the keys going forward, though, is going to be having Russia also on board. If you look at this from a geographic standpoint, not only is Russia a key player on the Security Council, but it is a major exporter of mineral resources such as oil, and it also is a past supporter of North Korea. And so it could potentially provide some of the access that China would be cutting off.
If China does not veto, will Russia stand alone to veto this draft?
I think that's unlikely. Moscow has its own issues right now with the United States, and we've seen that play out both in Syria and the Crimea, but we also saw in the case of Iran where they worked with the United States to take and limit the nuclear program on the Iranian side. But when we look at North Korea, they have similar concerns. And if you look back at the satellite launch, one of the strongest condemnations of North Korea's recent satellite launch was by Russia. So I think it's something where they want to be cooperative, but they also want to take and remind both the United States and China, who's essentially negotiated this bilaterally, that they are a key player as well.
Troy Sangaron says these sanctions would go beyond previous ones and that they cut off avenues the North has used to transport illicit and luxury goods. He says the full impact on the regime will take time, but rigorous implementation will, he says, be a way to force the North back to the negotiating table on both its banned missile and nuclear programs. Time for a look at what's going on the web today. And with details is social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky.
We've talked about on the show in the past the issue of migrants and refugees and how social media plays into their plight and their travels from their home countries into Europe. And Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, actually mentioned this over the weekend in Berlin. He was speaking at an event and said, quote, "Hate speech has no place on Facebook and in our community." Of course, Facebook and other social networks, in addition to helping these migrants and refugees, are places where people can speak out against them and use a lot of hate speech. So Zuckerberg's announced that Facebook is going to add refugees and migrants to their protected groups. Now, what this means is that people can't go and say hateful things and make threats against them on Facebook. And this is something we're actually going to talk about today on our show, Hashtag VOA. I encourage everyone to tune in at 1730 UTC. It's 1230 p.m. Eastern Time at voanews.com/hashtag VOA as we look at this issue of social media and how it plays into the plight of these migrants and refugees. And even though the Oscars were on Sunday night, the Academy Awards, Hollywood's biggest night in film, people are still talking about the awards ceremony and still talking about Leonardo DiCaprio, who captured his Best Actor Oscar. In fact, Leonardo DiCaprio's win and his speech was the most tweeted moment in Oscars history. There were more than 440,000 tweets per minute during his acceptance speech. Now, the previous record holder was 255,000 tweets per minute when comedian Ellen DeGeneres took a selfie and posted that to her Twitter feed, and that went viral with millions and millions of retweets. Well, now Leo not only has the Best Actor Oscar, he also holds this new Twitter record. So congratulations to him on that.
Thank you, Andrew. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A team of Dutch and American researchers have put a high-tech spin on the age-old art of fly fishing. The researchers have developed a new version of waders, those waterproof boots with pants used by fishermen to keep them dry as they wade through streams while fishing. These new high-tech waders have been equipped with temperature sensors to gather data that helps evaluate water quality and quantity. The wader sensors gauge water temperature and then sends the measurements via Bluetooth to an angler's GPS-equipped smartphone. According to the researchers, fishing enthusiasts would be able to immediately use this information to help them locate areas in the stream that are likely to have more fish. Meanwhile, the temperature data, along with the GPS-measured location, can be uploaded to the telephone where scientists can access it. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani and his allies have won 15 out of Tehran's 16 seats in an election for the country's important 88-member Assembly of Experts. Joining me here in the studio to talk about the development is Arash Sagarchi of our Persian service. Welcome, Arash.
Hello.
Can you share some of the details of this election?
We had the two elections in Iran on Friday. The first one was the election for parliament. All 30 seats for Tehran, the capital city, now were elected just reformist. And in the entire country, more than half are reformist and moderate. That is a big change in recent 12 years because, you know, for 12 years, the conservatives, they had a parliament, they had a government, and since 2013, a lot of change happened in Iran. Also, the election of Assembly of Experts at the same time was in Iran, and that was very important. The result shows moderates got win, too.
So what does this mean for the nation, really?
Actually, Hassan Rouhani, the president needed this parliament. The current parliament is a mix of conservatives and also extremists in Iran. So it can help Rouhani to make, you know, a better economy in Iran. Also, some expect to have more freedom by this parliament, of course. Frankly, more free law can be set by this parliament. We hear from a lady was elected from Tehran yesterday. She said the hijab is not mandatory. And this is new for many Iranians to hear that from a parliament member.
Well, does this reflect a major change in the attitude of the whole nation towards the West?
It should be. You know, right now, foreign policy is in supreme leader's hand. And but in the parliament, it means you will hear less, actually. You will hear less against the West from the new parliament member. 3 months ago, when Iran deal was considered in Iranian parliament, many extremists chanted death to U.S. and they were against the deal. But right now, many of them, they are not right now in the parliament for next parliament. And also, since next June, when the new members get the office, the parliament attitude will be more soft with Western countries.
Well, let me ask you this. The supreme leader, will this in any way change his positions on anything?
No, the supreme leader, no, there is no expectation to change his situation. But, you know, I think he was angry to this big change. Like last presidential election, many people believe that he is not angry to give power to moderates. But maybe he thought moderates can have a better deal and negotiation with West.
This might end up with a different relationship with the United States.
Maybe in future, why not?
Okay, well, thank you very much for visiting us here in the studio, Raj.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on International Edition, a preview of Super Tuesday and controversy at the Oscars. U.S. Republican and Democratic voters in many U.S. states are voting today for who they want to represent their parties in November's presidential election. VOA's Michael Lippin spoke with national correspondent Jim Malone, who's been following the opinion polls ahead of the Super Tuesday contest. They started with the Republican side.
The polls in the Super Tuesday states give Donald Trump a pretty good advantage. There's one state we're watching closely, which is Texas. That's the home state of one of Trump's rivals, Ted Cruz. Cruz is ahead in the latest polls, but it's close. But in most of the others, Donald Trump has anywhere from single-digit to double-digit leads, so he is positioned to do quite well on Super Tuesday.
And what is the strategy that Trump's main rivals are employing to try to close some of those gaps?
I would call it the kitchen sink strategy. They're trying to throw everything at him at this point. Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, is trying to go after Trump over the issue of why he won't completely distance himself from supportive comments made by a former Grand Dragon in the Ku Klux Klan, David Duke, for example.
Which is a white supremacist group.
Yes, and Rubio says this is disqualifying. Now, Trump says he's already said he disavows that support from Duke, but he's been pressed in media interviews, and there's been some interpretation as to whether he's gone far enough to distance himself from those comments. But in the case of Ted Cruz, it's a situation where he says we don't know what kind of president Donald Trump would be. And in fact, he questions whether he's even a real conservative. So the attacks on Trump from his rivals are really stepping up.
They've escalated.
And the party establishment is showing quite a bit of concern. Ben Sasse, a Nebraska senator, said he can't vote for Trump. So there are signs on one hand that there's great distress in the party, but then you have the endorsements by Chris Christie and Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions. So he's making some headway on the other side.
Now, do you think it's too late for some of these attacks on Trump to significantly affect the outcome? What is your feeling about that?
I would like to see what happens in terms of the question about the KKK supportive comments. Let's see if that has any impact on the voting on Tuesday. I would be watching that. But, you know, we've raised these issues so many times before with Donald Trump about supposedly outrageous comments that are made. Will they turn off his supporters? And we've seen no sign of it.
They didn't hurt him too much in the past, other controversies that he's waded into.
Right.
How about the Democrats? We've got Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Hillary Clinton seems to have the momentum right now. So how can we expect them to do on Tuesday?
I think because there are several southern states voting with large populations of African-American Democrats, that's going to help her quite a bit. I'm talking about states like Georgia, Arkansas, Tennessee, Virginia. She will probably do pretty well in those states, as she did in South Carolina on Saturday, where she really walloped Bernie Sanders. So Sanders has some concerns there. He's focused on states like Minnesota and Massachusetts, where the black voting bloc is less important.
And he has some leads in certain states?
It's close. It's close in Massachusetts, I would say. It's competitive. And Minnesota is a caucus state. We always have difficulty trying to divine in advance what's going to happen there. So he may be close in a few places. He could have a few breakthroughs. But she may wind up getting the lion's share of the delegates on Tuesday.
Which is what matters.
And that'll just add to that perception that she's the front runner and well ahead.
Well, thank you so much to our national correspondent, Jim Malone.
Thank you, Michael.
This is VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
You've heard of hybrid vehicles. Now comes hybrid planes. The UK-based budget airline EasyJet says it will begin trials of a passenger plane that uses a hydrogen fuel cell to taxi on the runway. Ian Davies is head of engineering with EasyJet.
We pulled together a kind of basic idea around, could we use a hydrogen fuel cell to power our aircraft now while they're on the ground?
EasyJet says it could save around 50,000 tons of carbon-producing fuel each year simply by using the hydrogen fuel cell prior to takeoff. Davies says the technology is already being used in vehicles like Toyota's Mirai.
We think we'll need around 150 kilowatt generator, which exists today in buses. And I thought, well, if we can power a car and a bus, surely we can power enough of the aircraft during the turnaround.
The hydrogen fuel cell will power motors in the plane's wheels, and the only waste product is water. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
Movie fans were able to watch their favorite stars together Sunday at the annual Academy Awards ceremony at the Dolby Theater in Los Angeles, California. The Oscars didn't do so well on television, with its lowest estimated viewership in the United States since 2008, about 34.3 million people. Still, there is a lot of buzz about the winners and some controversy, as we hear from International Business Times reporter Matthew Pressburg in Los Angeles and VOA's Jim Stevenson.
Well, it was interesting. I mean, the Academy Awards, the big takeaway is that, you know, diversity was the big issue. Ever since nominations were announced January 14th, the whole conversation's been about diversity. It's been about two straight years of all-white nominees in the acting categories. And with Chris Rock as the host, he was always going to address that early on. And his monologue was probably the highlight of the show. It was powerful. It was right to the point. It was funny. Some people thought he didn't hit the mark head-on. He shied away from some of the controversial issues. But I think, you know, it got a response. The crowd was excited. You know, people reacted to it. But the show kind of got away a little bit. Lady Gaga and the Vice President Joe Biden had a very powerful sexual assault presentation. But then we had sort of other pet issues come up. We had the director of The Big Short talking about, you know, how people shouldn't vote for somebody who takes money from Wall Street. We had Leonardo DiCaprio giving a big speech about climate change, which has been a pretty big conversation in Hollywood for, you know, 15, 20 years now. Very important issue, but it did seem like Chris Rock's powerful political message may have got away from him over the course of a show that ran about 4 hours.
The discussion about diversity included the groups that weren't being discussed. It was primarily about African Americans not being in the Oscars this year, but there were also discussions about Asians and others who also were not included.
And what was interesting was Chris Rock, one of his, you know, lowlights of the evening was when he made a joke about Asian children and accounting. It really didn't land, and it created kind of a furor on social media. were in the diversity Oscars, you know, an anti-Asian joke, I guess, was kind of the low light of the evening. So, you know, it really was. The Asian actors, the lack thereof, became a topic of conversation, and largely because of that joke.
And it was a huge evening for the Oscars on social media.
Oh, yeah. And not a great evening for the Oscars and the television ratings, but in social media, the conversation keeps getting bigger year after year. And especially with the political issues and with the, you know, wide open award ceremony where Spotlight and Underdog won Best Picture. Yeah, it really did spark a lot of social media conversation.
Leonardo DiCaprio finally got his Oscar for Best Actor. I almost envisioned him going up on stage and just holding his hands out and saying, "I'm on top of the world," and walking off the stage.
Right. I mean, it was a long time coming, and people were joking that maybe the climate change speech was in his back pocket for 10 years, and he was always going to give it when he was the Best Actor. But yeah, I mean, he was the overwhelming betting favorite on this. Everybody kind of thought it was coming, the sentimental favorite. There weren't tons of memorable performances opposite him. Leo was kind of, it was always going to be his coronation. Nobody was really surprised he won. A lot of people are happy for him, but I guess if this is the toughest thing he's had to go through in his career, we should all be so lucky.
And, of course, and we mentioned Spotlight. Those of us who are in the media and journalists were rather partial to that film.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, journalists love the fact that Spotlight won, but then again, we are journalists.
It was a bit of a surprise for that, because I think a lot of people were thinking, well, you know, maybe The Revenant would come out at the end.
Yeah, it was. A lot of people thought The Revenant, you know, would kind of complete the Triple Crown, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Picture, but no, it was Spotlight. But also this year, what was kind of interesting to me was that, you know, 10 Best Picture nominees, but if you think back at 2015 in film, Star Wars, Jurassic World, Furious 7, and to a lesser extent, Creed and Straight Outta Compton were huge popular hits. And if you watch the award ceremony, they really, you know, it was as if they weren't even released. And so there weren't a lot of big fan favorite movies in that Best Picture category. Mad Max was probably the most popular award-winning choice by the general movie audience. But yeah, I mean, so it kind of did create that opportunity for an underdog film like Spotlight to go and take that trophy.
Well, we hand the Oscar for Best Reporting following the ceremony to International Business Times entertainment reporter Matthew Pressburg. Matt, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
We would like you to invite, you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab and scroll to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One of the key propaganda points ISIL uses to cozen converts to its cause is to claim that its so-called caliphate's expansion is inevitable. But recent ISIL setbacks in Iraq and in northeastern Syria, particularly in and near the strategically significant town of al-Shaddadi, once again expose the hollowness of that claim. In the last few days, local Syrian defense forces, supported by the U.S.-led coalition, have reclaimed territory in an area that was a critical ISIL base and have continued to liberate the population from ISIL's grip. Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter said, "By encircling and taking this town, we're seeking to sever the last major northern artery between Raqqa and Mosul, and ultimately dissect the parent tumor into two parts, one in Iraq and the other in Syria." Thousands of local fighters were involved in the effort to drive out ISIL from al-Shaddadi, said Brett McGurk, Special Presidential Envoy for the Global Coalition to Counter ISIL. They included Kurds, Sunni Arabs, Christians. Mr. McGurk used a metaphor to describe this, saying, "There's a lot of different groups that are kind of shards of wood that want to fight ISIL. It's our job to try to pull them together, not just in a bundle, but in a bat. And what you have going now towards Shaddadi is a baseball bat." In a recent address, President Barack Obama emphasized that the fight against ISIL remains difficult and complex. But he noted that efforts to squeeze ISIL's core in Syria and Iraq have borne fruit. With the help of coalition training, equipment, and support, ISIL has now lost a series of key Iraqi towns and cities, more than 40% of what it once controlled in Iraq, including the city of Ramadi. Its leaders have been killed. Its oil infrastructure has been targeted in airstrikes, leading to a significant reduction in ISIL's oil production. Its cash storage sites have been destroyed, resulting in the slashing of salaries for ISIL fighters. Since the summer, ISIL has not had a single successful major offensive operation in either Syria or Iraq. In the end, the brutality of ISIL is no match for the yearning of millions who want to live in security and dignity, said President Obama. With allies and partners in the service of our dedicated personnel, we will destroy this barbaric terrorist organization and continue to stand with people across the region who seek a better and a safer future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.